Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today on the podcast, it's me, James Holland, going a little bit off-piste from my normal Second World War to talk about the bright young things.
Well, thank you very much, all of you, for coming. What an audience. I'm unusually nervous tonight, and I think it's because, for me, this is a very personal talk. I'm a historian of the Second World War, rather than specifically the in-between years. And yet, when I was growing up, my next-door neighbour was Cecil Beaton. We lived in Broadchalk next to Reddish House, and I do remember him. I remember vague things. I remember Bianca Jagger being photographed in the gardens. I wonder why. I remember our bantam cockerel escaping, and I remember it went into Cecil's lovely rose beds. And I remember he came out to help with a huge straw hat on with a big wide rim and a butterfly net. It was just, of course he did. I mean, it was just perfect. But sadly, he died when I was not quite 10. And I do remember the auction. It was amazing. And it seemed to me terribly sad at the time that all his things were being auctioned off. I couldn't understand why he didn't have someone to leave it all to. And I do remember all the cars coming in. And I remember the brochure, which I've still got to this day. And as I grew up, I became more and more interested in this. And I also was, as a young chap, I used to do an awful lot of art. And I had a real aspiration at one point to being a muralist. And Rex Wislett was my hero there. And I just love this idea of these creative people who all lived in my home county, and particularly my part of the home county, down here in southwest Wiltshire. Rex Wislett and Stephen Tennant and Cecil and Edith Olivier. And I've always hugely enjoyed looking at their work, reading their books. So to stand up here on this night when Rex Wislett at the wonderful exhibition in the Salisbury Museum, and if any of you haven't already seen it, I strongly urge you do. It's absolutely fabulous. There's been a Cecil Beaton exhibition of his war photographs at the War Museum. Wilton House are planning one on Cecil next year, which is very, very exciting. And sort of in homage to them, we've called our tents Beaton and Wislett, and we've even done our green room for our speakers up in a kind of, you know, a kind of sort of Cecil Beaton, Rex Wislett style. But to start off with, if I may, I'm going to take you back to spring 1930, Sunday the 6th of April, and to the Day House, which is, for any of you who've beetled up and down that the Quidhampton Road up to in Salisbury, you see the wall there, and then it nestles just behind there on the edge of the Wilton estate. And in 1930, that was lived in by Edith Olivier. And that weekend, she had a couple of house guests. Edith was 57. She had Cecil Beaton, who was a young and up-and-coming photographer, who was 26 at the time, and Rex Wislett, who was just 25. But they were close friends. And they'd been to church, had lunch, and then afterwards, Cecil and Rex were in kind of frivolous, gay moods, and they decided to dress her up, rather like a sort of Toulouse-Lautrec model. So first of all, they dressed her in one of Cecil's leopard skin, rather skin-tight dressing gowns. And then they started putting beads all around her neck, so she was absolutely weighed down with the amount of beads. And then they put on a large black straw hat. And finally, Rex started daubing her face with magenta rouge and whistling all the while he did it. They loved theatricals. They loved dressing up. It was all kind of part and parcel to them. And afterwards, sitting on her couch here in the long room, this was a room that Edith and her sister Mildred, when she was still alive, when they first moved to the Day House in about 1920, they added on this. This is a painting by Rex Wislett. It's a watercolour, and there is Rex on the right. There is Edith on her little chaise. That's actually Lord David Cecil, but might as well be Cecil for the purposes of this little anecdote. And this is actually a kind of effectively a wooden shack, but it looked, Rex has made it look rather grand. But anyway, they were sitting in here, which was their favourite room in the house, and suddenly, while still dressed up as this sort of weird figure with rouge and bright lipstick and beads and big hat, Edith started talking about the virtues of all the various counties of England, and then saying, but for me, you know, it's got to be Wiltshire. I mean, who can't be but seduced by the mystical power of this place? You know, the drama of southern Wiltshire, really, there's no finer place. And Cecil, who had been coming down here for a few years now, since he'd first met Edith 3 years earlier, thought, actually, you know what, you're right, I absolutely love Wiltshire. Rex, who had made the day house his spiritual home already, was also completely wedded to Wiltshire. But Cecil said, gosh, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a little sort of cottage down here where I could have my own place? I mean, he's only 26. And Edith says, do you know what, I actually know just the place. Because the other day I was talking to Stephen Tomlin, who's a sculptor who lived just off the A30, and he was telling me about this marvellous place nestling in the chalk downs below Wing Green on the way to Shaftesbury and between Shaftesbury and Tollard Royal. And it's a sort of derelict place, but it's even got a grotto. Well, for Cecil, this was absolutely it. He had to see it immediately. A grotto, this idea of this sort of sleeping beauty palace. I mean, you know, it was just too captivating for words. And they all said, well, let's go now. Why not? Let's strike while the iron's hot. So they went off, got in the car, drove off, picked up Stephen Tomlin, and drove down along the A30, and then up that winding hill that leads from Anstey, up over the hill, down to Alver Diston, where you get some of the finest views of the Chalk Valley. It's one of my favourite spots. And down there they went and turned right into Berwick St John, and then wove their way up this little track till they were just beneath Wynn Green, and then they dropped down again. But the track was rough, and eventually they had to give up the car and walk down the rest of the way. And there they found this amazing place, as I say, this sleeping beauty of a place where, surrounded in a sort of sylvan carpet of ilex and elms and beeches, and surrounded by this chalk horseshoe of chalk downs, it was a completely self-contained. And there in the midst of this was this house that had seen better days, but beautiful sort of brick kind of Queen Anne looking house. And for Cecil, this was love at first sight. I mean, you know, he'd never, love at first house, it was that as well. He'd never seen anything like it before. It was sort of derelict, had no running water, no electricity, none of the kind of sort of modern things that people would expect even in the 1930s. But it was empty, and that was the key thing. And everyone said, oh, come on, you must go and speak to the landlord. And here is Edith on that day, Sunday the 6th of April, 1930. And look at it, you can see the excitement on her face. I love this photograph because although it's not the greatest quality, you can see how her mind is spinning and thinking, yes, wouldn't this be marvellous? And actually, she did say that. She said, oh, Cecil, you've got to somehow get this because I feel this is a place that could inspire great work, whether it be writing and painting, and what fun it would be. And of course, this is, you know, Cecil needed no kind of, didn't need to hear Edith to say that. He was already completely seduced by this. So he immediately tried to contact the owner, who was a guy called Hugh Borley, who was a publican in Shaftesbury. And Borley was not for selling, but he was, you know, in the business for a bit of rentage. So he said, okay, you can have it for a seven-year lease at kind of £50 a year. And the deal was done. So who were these three people? Well, I'll start with Rex. This is a self-portrait of Rex in the early 1930s. You can see that his face is half shaded. There's a kind of sort of slightly haunted, wistful look to Rex, which I know people at the time found very alluring. But I can understand that. I can see there is you sort of want to get to know him. You want to understand what it is that makes him look a little bit wistful. He was an extraordinary artist. He, right from a very, very early age, he was incredibly imaginative and inventive, and he could just see something once in a book or a view or whatever and recreate it. He had an older brother who was just a year older than him called Denny, who he was very, very close to, who was also a very proficient artist, but who died tragically of pneumonia aged 11. And I always wonder whether that was what gave Rex his haunted look. Maybe he was just born with it, but maybe it was Denny, who he never really got over the loss of. Rex was... He went to Haileybury, he left there, got a place at the Royal Academy, was then kicked out of that, but immediately taken up by the Slade School of Art under the tutorship of Professor... God, I've forgotten his name completely. Tonks! Henry Tonks, Professor Henry Tonks, who completely immediately recognised his unique talent, his unique ability of draftsmanship, and to just visualise things and create things completely from his imagination. The other person he met when he was at Slade in his first term and became very quick firm friends with was the young Stephen Tennant, who was a second son of Lady Pamela Grey, formerly Lady Glenconner, who then married Lord Grey as a second marriage. And Lady Grey had a house in Wilsford in the Woodford Valley. And Stephen was a fascinating character. Only 16 and a half when he went to Slade for the first time, but precocious, witty, rather delicate, rather sort of ethereal looking you, very, very beautiful, suffering from tuberculosis, which accounted for the kind of wanness of him, but eccentric and funny. And immediately he and Rex, who was something of an outsider, struck up a rapport. They liked reading poetry to each other, Shakespeare and Walter de la Mare and others, and they would wander around London marvelling at the architecture and so on. And eventually Rex got invited down to Wilsford. Stephen was, as I say, a kind of sort of rather fey, extraordinary man. I mean, people who met him didn't forget him in a hurry, even as a sort of young, sort of 16, 17-year-old. But inviting Rex down to Wilsford opened his eyes to a different world. Rex's background was very middle class. His father was a builder from Essex originally, quite successful builder, but not an artistic man, not a cultured man. And suddenly here was this life of privilege. The doors had been opened into a sort of a gilded world of sort of aristocracy and art and fabulous things and wonderful objet d'art and witty conversation and poetry. And Stephen was a very proficient artist as well and an aspiring writer. And this really opened Rex's eyes. But it's interesting, isn't it, this picture here, there's Stephen in the middle, looking sort of gaunt, but kind of very, very posed. Rex on the side there, sort of slightly aloof, slightly to one side, sort of looking down on the assembled party. The other thing that that Stephen provided Rex was the opportunity to travel. Here's Rex on the right, looking very dandified in his check socks and his big cap. There's Stephen. They went abroad to Switzerland in October 1924. Because it was considered still, I mean, TB in those days was still kind of, no one really knew what the cure was, and it was considered, you know, clean air and good health and mountains and all the rest of it was good for you. So they're en route to Switzerland with Stephen's nanny, to whom he was completely doted. And for Rex, who couldn't afford anything like this, this was a wonderful opportunity to go and see Europe and again open his eyes to different culture and different art and architecture. And Stephen, of course, you know, when they went, he managed to get them two suede cases embossed with their initials. They went first class, no expense spared. You know, you can imagine the middle-class boy from Essex. This is quite a kind of a big step up in the social strata. You can also see, I think, where some of the sort of allusions to Brideshead Revisited, where Evelyn Waugh gets some of his ideas from. It's never been confirmed that Sebastian Flight was based on Stephen Tennant, but the similarities are, you can't avoid them, to be perfectly honest. And again, here's the young artist. Charles Ryder, of course, famously does the mural at Castle Howard. Not Castle Howard, what am I talking? Brideshead Castle. And Stephen Tennant, you know, the sort of slightly fey, wan, kind of mysterious character, doted on his nanny. So you can see how this sort of, for Rex, this is a real awakening. This is an education in itself. He's worrying about what Professor Tonks is going to say, but Professor Tonks says, look, you're far better off going and seeing marvellous architecture around Europe than you are staying here in London. Go with my blessing. So all is fine. Then later on, Lady Grey comes out at Christmas 1924 and says, do you know what, Stephen, I think you need to stay a little bit longer. I'm going to stay with you. And then I think, actually, now that spring is coming, let's go and get a place in Italy. So she hires the Villa Natalia in San Remo on the Ligurian coast. And it's here for the first time that Rex meets Edith Olivier. Now, Edith is another very, very interesting character. I'd have loved to have met all these people properly. I know I sort of briefly met Cecil, but I really would have loved to have met them all. And Edith, I'm fascinated by. She was 54 at this time, in 1925. And she was one of 10 children to the Canon Dacres Olivier, who was the vicar of Wilton. And he sort of ruled in a very kind of Victorian way, ruled his household very autocratic, and rather sort of slammed down on Edith's obvious talents. She somehow sort of missed out getting married. She went to Oxford briefly. She was very bright, very clever, but had bad asthma and had to leave after 4 terms. And as I say, never quite got married, slightly living in the shadow of her father. In the First World War, she did lots of good deeds, sort of working, setting up the local land girls, worked for the WI, was a good Christian soul. And then her father died in 1919, and they lost a canonry. Her mother had already passed away. The rest of the family, apart from her older sister, Mildred, had gone. And her and Mildred were offered from the Pembrokes the old dairy house in Wilton, which they renamed in its old-fashioned way the Day House, D-A-Y-E. And there they moved in. But then Mildred, very soon after, contracted cancer and in 1924 died. Now, Edith had known Pamela Gray for a long, long time. As children, they had played in Wilton Estate together and had known Stephen since birth. But as Pamela came out to Switzerland and planned this house in San Remo, they started thinking about people they could invite. And she thought, well, poor old Edith, you know, she's just lost her sister. Maybe she should come out too. It'd be nice for her. And actually, another person who was very influential in that decision was Stephen himself. And Stephen was terribly fond of Edith, not least because there was a sort of meeting of minds when they put on a play in 1923 in Wilton House to raise money. It was a little pantomime written by Edith about Bluebeard, and the 17-year-old Stephen was the female lead, Thamina, the Bluebeard's wife, and they got on like a house on fire. And the great thing about Stephen was that he liked people because he liked them, not because you were supposed to be with a certain set of people or a certain type of people. You know, he just liked Edith. Edith made him laugh. She amused, you know, he found her amusing and clever and witty. He enjoyed her conversation. And Stephen never distinguished between his friends. If you could be 60, you could be 100, you could be 12. If he liked you and you were his friend. And that was his attitude. And so Edith came out and immediately got on like a house on fire with Rex. They struck up an amazing rapport. And actually, a friendship was starting to be forged, which would be Rex's, certainly his greatest friendship of his life, and probably Edith's as well. And one of the things they did was they bobbed her hair very quickly and said, come on, you look much better like that, Edith. And she liked the kind of younger self she was. And it was as though the youth of Edith that had been sort of slightly stifled, slightly stamped down upon under her autocratic father was now able to sort of come to the fore again in a way that she hadn't been able to enjoy when she'd been younger. When they eventually got back from Italy, their little kingdom by the sea, Edith and Rex met up in London. They had a great day together, and then she invited him down for the weekend to the day house. There was no suggestion of this ever being anything other than a platonic friendship. There really wasn't. There was no sexual involvement whatsoever. But she loved Rex. She loved his intensity. She loved the fact that she caught him having gone for a walk to the Palladian Bridge in the Wilson Park. The next morning, there he was doing this sketch and just doing it from memory. I mean, she found that absolutely fascinating. And there she is. You can see this is the new Edith, no longer the frumpy Edith of old. This is Edith that is embracing the new world that is emerging out of the First World War. I think it's a fabulous picture, this, isn't it? I mean, she looks terribly seductive, I'm not sure, but rather glorious, I think. And then what about Cecil? Well, Cecil is the, I suppose, the fourth of, of our characters. Cecil, like Rex, a middle-class background. His father is a timber merchant in London. His mother is the daughter of a blacksmith from Cumbria. He has been to private school. He's been to Cambridge. He leaves without a degree, but his first love is photography. And he's taught photography by his nanny, curiously enough, who's given him a Kodak 3A. And taught him the rudimentaries of photography. And this is where he wants to go. This, he feels, is his ticket to a different world, a world beyond the sort of middle-class constraints, rather sort of humdrum constraints. After Cambridge, he does a couple of office jobs, absolutely hates it, and eventually breaks off on his own. And he's helped by this. First of all, he starts doing a lot of pictures of his two sisters, who are very pretty, very beautiful, and they're no longer just straight portraits with nothing behind, with just a sort of dark background, rather like a sort of old formal kind of, I don't know, 17th century portrait or something. This is now a work of art in itself. Lots of shadow, lots of dressing up. And he comes to the attention through this, through a little bit of work with Vogue, through a few little photographs in the right places. He comes to the attention of the Sitwells, who are three siblings who are very much on the sort of leading literary and artistic scene of the time. And here's Edith Sitwell, and the nod to history, the theatricals, the dressing up. There she is, sort of pretending to be dead, dressed up as, I don't know, Joan of Arc or something. I mean, it's sort of bonkers, but rather brilliant. And Osbert Sitwell then puts on an exhibition for Cecil, and it causes quite a stir, and this is his entree. And he's desperate to meet Stephen Tennant about, who is already by this stage the brightest of bright young things that are being talked about in the gossip columns. Aristocratic, devil-may-care, seemingly hedonist. This is a piece of the pie that Cecil absolutely wants. And he eventually meets Stephen just before Christmas, 1926. And Stephen immediately goes, "Oh, I love your work. It's just so fabulous. And I want you to portrait me. I want you to do a picture of me sort of as though I'm Ophelia dying in the river." And Cecil goes, "Brilliant. I'm up for that." And off they go. And they take lots of fabulous pictures, including this one. This is one of my all-time favorite Cecil photographs. And it's taken in Stephen's silver room. At Mulberry House in Smith Square, which is the Tennant family pile in London. And Stephen's dealt with his rooms by putting tin foil, silver tin foil, on a lot of the walls. The sky is deep blue. The carpet is black, the only other sort of offset by a polar bear skin, and his alligators in a tank to one side. It's pretty stark, it's pretty weird. This is 1927 we're talking about, January 1927. And he has a sort of penchant for this rather shiny leather Mac, but doesn't he look brilliant? I mean, camp, yes, beautiful, yes, and you can see, you know, the old Edwardian world has gone with Stephen around. This is a new world, an exciting world, and if you're Cecil and you share a lot of these same views, this excitement for the new world and the new age and new ways of doing things, then this is pretty great. And to beat it all, Stephen then invites him down to Wilsford, just as he had invited Rex 4 years earlier. And when he goes down there, Rex is there, various other brilliant people are there, lots of bright young things, and they have lots of sparkling conversation, they get drunk, they dress up, and at the end of it, Cecil thinks, "Ah, oh, thank God, I feel I've come of age. These are the people who understand me. This is the world I want to be part of." And it just gets even better, because by March, Stephen has gone down to Cap Ferrat in the French Riviera with various people, including Edith here, and Rex. And then he has invited Cecil, saying, "Cecil, you've just got to get down here right now." And so he gets on the boat train and down he goes and joins them. And again, this is the Scott Fitzgerald world. This is bright young things. This is a world where the sun always shines, an absolute golden age. And you can see why Cecil just loves it. He just thinks it's brilliant. 1927 is a really interesting year in the lives of these four, I think. Stephen has never been better known. Everyone loves him. Everyone's taking photographs of him. He's in all the gossip columns. He is known for his witty conversation, for his beauty, for being outrageous, for being a steam sealer. And he's not the most brilliant artist, but he is a brilliant artist. I mean, he's not sort of struck with genius, but he has a brilliance about him because he's a trendsetter. He is leading a new way of doing things. Rex he's just completed his expedition for the pursuit of rare meats. This is one of the panels which lines the Tate Gallery restaurant, which you can still go and enjoy a fabulous lunch or dinner down there in the Rex in the Tate restaurant. And anyone who hasn't done it, save up and go and do it because it's an amazing experience. And you can see here the sort of the Italian influence there. So this is his big moment. The great and the good come to the launch of it, to the opening of it in early 1927. For Cecil, his career has never been is on the up. It's on the rise. He's getting more commissions from Vogue. He's painting. He's taking photographs of more and more of famous and well-known people. There's weekends at Wilsford, where here they are down at Wilsford. They're all dressing up. There's Rex in the end, sort of again, slightly on the edge, slightly looking not quite as comfortable as the others. Cecil, loving every second. Stephen, loving every second. That's William Walton, the composer, in the middle. So this sort of rarefied set of artists and movers and shakers and composers. And for Edith, it's also the time where she writes her first novel, Love Child, which is a huge critical and commercial success. So suddenly she, after the kind of loss of her sister, about which she's grief-stricken, about her change of circumstances, suddenly she's got these bright young friends who are making her feel young and brilliant, and Cecil is going up in the world, Rex is doing well, Stephen's holding court, everything is right with the world. So back to Ashcombe. Well, 3 years on, the group of friends are still close, still having a great time, still going well with their careers. This is Cecil here in Ashcombe after it's been done up. He undertakes the reparations of Ashcombe all himself. He goes on his own grand tour around Europe, just in the old-fashioned sort of, you know, the 18th century fashion of any fine young gentleman. That is what one did. He does it too. He takes a man he's completely besotted with, Peter Watson. Sadly for Cecil, that doesn't work out, but he has a wonderful time with Peter, going around buying furniture, shipping it all back to Ashcombe. Rex designs that doorway, ornate doorway for him. This is a time of hope. I mean, Rex and Cecil, and Stephen to a certain extent as well, they love the Rococo period. You could see in the mural of Rex's, the influence of sort of 18th century French paintings, sort of Watteau and Fragonard and Boucher and people like that. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau always said that, you know, one had one's greatest thoughts when surrounded by nature. And this is something that Rex and Cecil and Stephen and of course Edith all completely buy into. There's something about Ashcombe, it's completely cut off from everyone. Here they can be themselves, they can do what they want. They're away from the censorious eyes of the wider world. They can, as Edith suggested, be artistic and creative and no one's to criticise. They can sort of do what they like. You know, so they're still very, very young people, Cecil and Rex and Stephen. And here you can see again that influence of the 18th century French landscape artists. Here, this is another of Rex's murals at Hill Street in London. Again, sort of Italianate, romantic, the suggestion of a sort of ruin in the distance. That tree, the way the trees are painted, again, very 18th century. These are the influences. And again, you can see this is an interior of Ashcombe, very Gaudi, over the top, theatrical, flamboyant cupids and gold and white and silver and so on. But again, just fabulous, really. He runs out of money, so he gets his bedroom painted. He invites a few of his great mates down there. There's Oliver Messel, the stage designer, who's been at the Slade with Rex and Stephen. Rex comes down, various other, Lord Berners comes, and they all paint these little murals over one weekend. And in the bathroom, what he does is he gets all his guests to outline their hands and then sign it. And up there is Salvador Dali later on in the 30s, and H.G. Wells, and all sorts of people. You know, for Cecil, he's a complete social climber who loves his kind of address book. This is just a great time. And the weekends are spent painting. This is there's Edith on the ground there. There's Cecil. There's Rex and Cecil painting. And this is the product of that picture, that painting session. This is Rex's picture of Ashcombe with the doves. And you can see that surrounding of chalk there, can't you? And how enclosed they are, and how this is their own little secret kingdom. And picnics and this is a time of liberation, of freedom, of no responsibility really. But they're all grown ups; they can do what they like. But they're no responsibilities to anyone else. This is a golden time. I suppose the greatest moment for Cecil in his tenureship of Ashcombe came in July 1937, 10th of July to be precise, when he decided to hold, when he held his Fête Champêtre, which was sort of famous in the annals of Wiltshire set parties. Months in the planning, he did all sorts of pictures and sketches of it beforehand, planning every single room. It was going to be a kind of sort of homage to, again, to the 18th century and the 19th century. There's Rex there clapping on the sort of the country dancers that came in. Everyone was there, everyone who was anyone. Even Stephen came for that one as well, who'd become something of a recluse by that stage. But despite that, despite the sort of the giddiness of the Fête Champêtre, that was in a way marking the end of that golden period. Things were changing in their lives. Stephen had started an affair at the end of 28, with Siegfried Sassoon, the war hero, the poet, more than 20 years his senior. Theirs had been a tempestuous four-year affair. Stephen, who was still sort of suffering from TB, felt a lot of the time claustrophobic and cloyed by the attentiveness of Siegfried. Later he broke with him, said, I never want to, you know, he got his solicitor to write him a letter saying, I'm sorry, but Stephen doesn't want to ever see you again. That was that, cut off completely. And by that stage, he was suffering from sort of mental illness, had become more and more reclusive. Frustrated, I suppose, as well, that his artistic aspirations had sort of not really been realised. Yes, he'd written a few books. Yes, he'd done a few illustrations. Yes, he'd done a few paintings, but nothing like in Rex's League. He'd not enjoyed the success of someone like Cecil, for example, or even to a certain extent to Edith as well. And he was getting older. He wasn't quite so gaunt and thin and beautiful and ephemeral as he used to be. By the mid-1930s, he was just fleshing out a little bit and not looking quite so remarkable. He recovered a little bit in the mid-30s and went on a big tour of America. He became obsessed with the American writer Willa Cather, and went over there to meet her and wandered around America and disappeared from the scene. Lots of periods in sanatoriums. Eventually, he sort of came back a little bit in the late 1930s and did make the famous Fête Champêtre at Ashcombe in July 1937, wearing a fabulous blue outfit. But this was one of his last major appearances at a big sort of sociable function like that. For the rest of his life, he kind of withdrew quite considerably, and it's almost upsetting, really, to see this picture. This is from the mid-1940s, him holding a children's party at Wilsford. But you can see how chubby he's become, and he no longer looks young and beautiful. And that's sort of part of the point of him. So when that's gone, he just hides himself away a little bit. It's a sort of tragic end. The irony is, of course, is that sickly, wasted, thin and gaunt, but beautiful Stephen turns into this extremely robust and well, cured completely of TB, rather chubby, kind of late 30-something by the time this photo has been taken. And for the much of the rest of his life, he spends in bed and not really moving at all, wearing more and more outlandish makeup and dyeing his hair. And curiously enough, Philip Hoare, who wrote his biography, visited his house just after he'd died and just before the auction happened. And he went up onto the landing and he could smell Stephen's perfume. Suddenly, this strong smell of him. Maybe Stephen's ghost, who knows? And what about Rex? For Rex as well, the 30s, though hugely successful in terms of his artistic career, were frustrating too. Rex's problem was that by the standards of his aristocratic and privileged friends, he was pretty poor. Now, it's all relative. He wasn't poor, but he had a lot to spend his money on. He had to keep up with the rest of the gang. He bought houses for his parents. His father was getting ill. His business was over. No pension. Had to sort him out. He paid for his younger brother, Lawrence, to go through Balliol. So a lot of his money was being siphoned off into the family. And then there was the sort of keeping up with the Joneses. And what that meant was he was constantly broke. And what that meant was that he had to do more and more work and spread himself more thinly than perhaps he would have liked. So he would do these kind of panels, lots of illustrations, wonderful paintings like this of Wilton House, but then also book illustrations like this, which again are just sublime, but there's something kind of not quite serious artist about doing book illustrations. And this was something that kind of certainly did slightly affect his career. Later in the 30s, he fell madly in love with Penelope, or Pempy, as she's known on the left, Dudley Ward. The Dudley Ward daughters, Angela and Pempy, were the daughters of the Prince of Wales' mistress. Here's a portrait of them. But this was another very chaste relationship. Siegfried Sassoon once had this feeling that Rex was madly in love with him, and that if he'd given him the nod, they could have become lovers. Personally, I don't think that really adds up. I don't think Rex was openly homosexual at all. And I think that is Siegfried suffering from damaged ego from being shunned by Stephen, kind of liking to think that actually there was still something in the old dog yet. And if he couldn't have Stephen, then perhaps Rex, as his best friend, would do. I don't think Rex was in the slightest bit interested in a sexual relationship with Siegfried Sassoon. However, it is no question that he was slightly in awe of this guy, and who wouldn't be? You know, famous war hero, famous war poet, and so on. But he never felt he could take advantage of Pempy. When he first went out to dinner, invited her to dinner in London, she went to the most expensive place. He had to pay the bill. You can just imagine the cringing as he sort of fumbled for his wallet, thinking, oh God, this is a bit steep. You know, I love you, but. It just said to Edith, you know, this is absolutely hopeless. You know, this is a hopeless case. I can never marry her. I can't take advantage of him. Curiously enough, there's a touch of the Victorian, funnily enough, about Rex. You know, he's a modernist. He likes cars. You know, he and Stephen used to love going to see westerns and all things America. And yet he harks back to this age of sort of 18th century chivalry. And of sort of Victorian morals, where you couldn't possibly even kiss a girl if you couldn't afford to keep her and marry her. And so, although he loves Pempy, he never kind of, you know, he never acts on it. And the affair, just sort of the platonic affair, sort of the lust fizzles out. He later has an affair, and does have a sexual affair, with Tallulah Bankhead, the Hollywood film star who comes over to London, and they kind of they have a sort of a few weeks of. Interesting times in a rather nice hotel in London. And he then falls desperately in love with Caroline Paget, who's a great beauty of the age, but cool and aloof, and decidedly bisexual. And Rex gets this wonderful commission to go and do what becomes his masterpiece, the Plas Newydd murals in Anglesey, the seat of Lord Anglesey. And there, Caroline Paget, who is the daughter of Lord Anglesey, and Rex, and Lady Patricia Douglas, who at the time is 19 and is rather infatuated with both Rex and Caroline, and they have this rather weird menage a trois where they kind of go swimming naked in the lake together and lie on beds and have a sort of kiss and a cuddle, but again, don't actually have sex. They just sort of smooch about each other and sort of talk about beauty and things. And Caroline is not really for Rex. And eventually Patricia becomes completely besotted with Rex, but he doesn't want her, he wants Caroline. And Patricia, who's young and impressionable and getting a an aristocratic marriage lined up for her, then does go and marry the Count de Bendern and goes off and leaves Rex's life for the time being. So again, and this is the Place Neuwied mural, and trust me, this just doesn't even remotely do it justice. It's just the most fabulous piece of work. And just imagine that has come purely from his imagination. It's just breathtaking, isn't it, to think how you could just sit there and conjure that up. It is absolutely vast as well, I have to say. Oops, sorry, gone too fast. So the 1930s, a time of frustration for Rex as well. But then comes war, September 1939, and the lives of this little group change forever with war. For Cecil, he feels it's like a death knell being sounded. A lot of the young guys in your 19 or 20, it sounds terribly exciting, and you're gagging to go and fly a Spitfire or join up and do your stuff. But when you're in your 30s, this is a whole new serious game, and it sounds like nothing but complete awfulness. The other thing that Cecil finds is that he's just completely ill-equipped for the war. You know, he feels useless. He feels completely unable to do anything. He offers himself as a sort of camouflage artist, but is turned down. He becomes a little volunteers as a driver. No one wants him to do that. Eventually, he ends up manning the telephone in the ARP unit at Wilton, and here he is peering through the window, looking slightly nonplussed and going, where did all the Halcyon years go? Later on, in 1940, he gets taken on by the Ministry of Information as a photographer, and suddenly he zooms back into focus. I mean, the one thing he does say is, the war has sapped my interest for those golden days. I no longer want to party. This is serious stuff now. I need to grow up. I need to get with, I want to kind of become a new person. And boy, does he do so. He produces fabulous photographs. This is of Eileen Dunn that he takes on a trip to the north of England in August 1940. This little three-year-old girl who's been slightly injured by a German bomb, clutching her teddy, rather sort of moth-eaten teddy by the looks of things, but look at that expression, look at that face. And it gets put on the front cover of Life, this particular edition, in September 1940. And it couldn't have come at a better time. What Cecil does for the war effort, the Britain's war effort, is absolutely enormous, because, as I'm sure many of you are aware, in America in 1940 there is a complete split between those who are for war and going in and helping Britain and saving the world, and those who want to be isolationist. And this did a huge, huge good for the pro getting involved lobby, and certainly helped Britain stake out there, helped ease the passage of the 50 destroyers and all sorts of things. A really, really important photograph. And in the spring of 1941, he takes a whole load of RAF photographs. He then gets posted out to the Middle East in early 1942. And here he is with his RAF uniform on. And isn't it amazing that someone like Cecil in the Second World War could end up wearing a uniform for real, not just for dressing up, but for real? And that is the amazing thing to me about the Second World War, that everyone was involved. And here are some of these sort of hugely iconic photographs he takes. One of the great amazing skills about Cecil is how whatever field of photographic work he moves into, he moves with the time, he develops it, he takes it on a different notch. He knows what is required for that particular task. And here you've got a desert sandstorm, and it just evokes it perfectly. You can feel the wind, can't you, hurtling across the desert there. And here, sort of litter of battle in the sand. And again, this ruined tank, one of the most famous war photographs ever produced by a British photographer. But look at the portraits too. Again, what's brilliant about these portraits is you can see the personality of the person. Cecil kept very detailed diaries all his life. They're wonderfully gossipy, wonderfully bitchy, and particularly the unexpurgated ones. And you can still go and see them. They're all housed in St. John's College in Cambridge, which is where he was a student. And once you get used to deciphering the handwriting, they're just an absolutely wonderful read. And he always nails other people. And he does wonderful written character sketches, but boy, those photographic character sketches are good. You can tell this girl, this is a real Wren, and you can see she's not suffering any fool, is she? She's not going to be done down by some bloke. But also, she's a complete minx. You just know she is. And how about that one? Yeah, I mean, again, you just know what he's like. Now, if I told you that he amputated his own hand in the First World War, you're not going to be surprised, are you? General Adrian Carton de Wyatt. One of my favourite photographs. But boy, you wouldn't want to cross him, would you? Rex, on the other hand, doesn't go for the safe job. He has various opportunities for it. He's overlooked by Kenneth Clark as one of the official war artists. Again, because he's probably spread himself too thinly in the 1930s. But he has certainly plenty of opportunities. He's quite, you know, he's getting on a little bit. He's in his mid-30s at the beginning of the war, but he joins up immediately. And he doesn't just join any old unit. He decides to go for the Welsh Guards. He gets an interview, gets in, and here's the self-portrait he did on the day that he first bought his uniform from an apartment overlooking Hyde Park. Again, look at that wistfulness in his eyes. Is there something there where he knows this is a one-way journey? I'm not sure. Maybe just me being fanciful, but there's a winsomeness, isn't there? A wistfulness about that expression. Again, it's just a fabulous portrait. And it's interesting. He was beloved by his men. He wasn't your typical Welsh Guards officer. Apparently, when he used to do route marches, he used to say to them, "Oh, look at that wonderful church over there," and start talking about light and things. And they all thought, you know, you can imagine all these kind of sort of these young taffies just thought it was absolutely hilarious. Their commanding officer, their sort of platoon leader, talking to them about art and beauty and architecture. But they absolutely adored him. In 1941, the 2nd Battalion becomes mechanised. Even though they're guards, foot guards, in a sort of reconnaissance tank role. And they moved to Codford, just down the road from a lot of his old haunts. And here's a picture of him. That's again, he often puts himself in these pictures. That's him, the bell tents and stuff. Suddenly you can see there's a sort of a new lightness into his artwork. He is absolutely so busy during the war, despite doing his training, despite doing route marches and training to be a tank commander. He also finds plenty of time to do book illustrations and more artwork and stuff. And he also spends a lot more time with Edith, who he slightly neglected through all his sort of his period of being a love slave in the 1930s. And here again, here's that wonderful picture of, there's his car. He goes in May, 1941, he decides it's right at the end of the Blitz, but he takes out all his prized possessions from London, from his apartment in Fitzroy Street, and takes them down to Edith and says, "Edith, you know, can you look after them while I'm here, and you can keep my car here and everything." And that May of 1941, he says to Edith, "Gosh, you know, Southern Wiltshire has never looked lovelier, has it? It was a fine, fine early summer, that summer of 1941. And as we all know, Southern Wiltshire, those last 2 weeks of May, doesn't it look fantastic? And you can see, again, much more light. You think how sort of muted the colours were on all those murals. And then suddenly, this is just, it's so much life and vitality there, isn't there? There's so much sort of joy in the light and the pictures. And finally, he's painting Edith as well, there in at the day house. He's never painted the day house before the war starts, curiously enough. And then suddenly, it's almost where he's sort of sentimental for it. And here he is. He grows a moustache because that's the sort of military sort of thing to do. Makes him look a bit more austere, a bit older, I suppose, sort of slightly more his age. I mean, he looks every inch the Guards officer there. He also embraces army life. He's not a natural guardsman, but he does all these sketches for the men, including how you should lay out kit. He does Christmas cards. He paints the mess. He also finds time to meet up with Lady Patricia Douglas, or Lady de Bendern, as she is by this stage, who has been evacuated with her young daughter to America, but has come back in 1942 and meets Cecil again at the day house where she's staying with Edith. And they then do have a physical affair. They spend a sort of a week together in bed in Claridge's. And then she goes back to, as you did in the war, it's wartime. Then she shoots off back to America and never sees him again. And eventually, having trained throughout the first part of the war in England and never been sent overseas, they are finally lined up for Normandy. And with the big invasion in June 1944, the 2nd Battalion is sent over, and they first go into action on the 18th of July for the launch of Operation Goodwood, which is the biggest armoured battle any British forces ever face in the entire Second War, in fact, ever, full stop. And at that moment, they are facing a density of German armoured divisions, mostly Waffen-SS divisions, the most dense formations of any opposition of anywhere in the war, more so than any Russians ever faced on the Eastern Front. It's a devastating battle. And late on that afternoon of the 18th of July, as Rex is getting back towards his tank, the mortar shell lands, blows him 10 foot into the air, breaks his neck instantly, and he's killed. There's not a blemish on his body. Now, a lot of people, when they write back about their people who have been killed, they say that, but this has been validated by a number of people that he was untouched. It was just the blast and the breaking of the neck that did for him. But isn't this tragic? Isn't this romantic? My darling Edith, written on the July the 9th, came tied up with a little package of Cheez-Its from Normandy, which he sent over to her. A little present from Normandy with much love. Writing you today with what news I can give. Very, very poignant, very, very sad. But Rex was no more. And when Cecil heard the news, he was in America at the time, and he couldn't believe it. And he recalled how Rex had been to see him in his house in London on his last leave before the invasion, and had told him that he didn't think he would make it through. And it's amazing how often those people with that sort of that sixth sense that they're not going to make it, how often that becomes a sort of self-fulfilled prophecy. Cecil in America just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. He completely broke down. He's much to the embarrassment of himself and all the people that were with him, but he was completely uncontrollable with grief. And when he came back from the war, when peace finally came, he found that he had to leave his beloved Ashcombe. Edith Olivier, he was kicked out after two lots of 7-year leases, eventually had 15 years, and kicked out in 1947, having done this. But in a way, it was sort of fitting, because that age was over. It was the dawn of a new period in Cecil's life. Edith managed to find him Reddish House in Broadchurch, which he lived until his death, and where I got to know him. And there is Edith at the day house. She died, sadly, in 1947. Stephen, as I say, outlived them all, but a complete recluse. That period of the Wiltshire Set, which I really do think they were very influential in their way, was over, really, with the end of the war. That's the day house today. Just a few days ago, I was lucky enough to, thanks to Chris Rolfe, the estate manager at Wilton, managed to take me round there, and the people who live in there now very kindly let me go and have a look. And you just go back, there's that, those same windows, there's Edith in all that lovely sunshine in May 1942, and there it is today on a grey June day, thankfully perking up a little bit. Then we found this, it's a bit blurred, but this is all that remains of the long room. I started with that picture of the long room in the day house with Cecil and Edith and Rex all holding forth on that wonderful day in Sunday, April 1930. And on the beam, or across one of the beams in the long room, Rex had written that and done some little florid patterns along it and saying, "Darling Edith." And that's all the remains of it. There it is. The Wilton House now have it, just the beam. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.